Globalization of trade has run into the buzzsaws of nationalist reaction and the coronavirus. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. There is no doubt that the recent period of globalization has produced tremendous economic growth, but its economic displacement has also produced political movements, the most recent being Trumpism with its tariffs. Meanwhile, a new threat has arisen with the coronavirus pandemic, which promises to dampen economic growth and trade. Edward Goldberg, who teaches at New York University's Center for Global Affairs, has written a new book entitled Why Globalization Works for America, and we have him on the phone this morning. Welcome to the program.
Great. Good morning, and thanks for having me on.
So I want to turn, by the way, to the pandemic, because it seems to me that it symbolizes the impact that globalization has taken place in terms of how people relate, the fact that people can't necessarily go out and visit Europe anymore. What has, first of all, been the impact, and what does that mean in terms of globalization, the fact that this has such an impact?
Well, one, of course, it's kind of personally frustrating that as Americans, we can't travel anywhere in the world. We used to have, you know, our passport used to be gold, and now nobody wants us. So that's, to say the least, a little bit frustrating. But, you know, I really believe the virus, like the pandemic, what I call the pandemic of global warming to come, is a definition of why globalization is important. You can't build walls around the virus, just like you can't build walls around global warming. Basically, you know, you need an international effort to stop this. And of course, that's missing.
Well, in terms of globalization, it seems to me that it's a force to be reckoned with. No matter how many tariffs are put up, no matter what countries do, things either get outsourced to other countries or they get automated.
Well, you look at what happened here in the United States. First of all, job loss in the United States because of globalization has not really been a problem in the last 10 years. It's been automation, as you just said. You know, in 1970, it took 10 people to make a ton of steel. Today, it takes one. This is why the president's tariffs on steel had no logic to them. Or look at outsourcing. So you can buy a pair of jeans for $50, $60 in Gap today, approximately. If they were made in the States, they would cost in the $340 area. You know, that differential is tremendous money into the average person's pocketbook. It's an indirect stimulus into the economy that makes the economy even grow more.
So what do you say to people who they look at China, for instance, who obviously has a growing economy, and they see jobs either being going over there or certainly has become, I think somebody described it as sort of the factory of the world. What is their prognosis and how do they fit into this globalization?
Well, for sure, China's economy has grown greatly. I mean, since Deng Xiaoping's time, since they became semi-capitalist, in fact, which was a goal of the United States at that time. And for sure, they've taken a lot of manual labor jobs from the United States. Basically, this has ended, as I said, in the last 10 years or so. But the reality is, I kind of look at it differently. I see the U.S., we are the leaders in human capital, in knowledge industries. And there's a very famous economist called David Ricardo from the 19th century, and he said a country should produce what it can export, what it can make the most efficiently. And we are the leaders in human capital products, whether that's Google, whether that's Apple, any of these products. This is what we should be doing. This is how we should be making our money, not making jeans.
I want to turn to Russia for a moment, because it seemed as if there was a moment after the wall fell that perhaps there might be something economically that might revive Russia, and yet it seems to have fallen into simply being a supplier of raw resources.
This is Russia. I honestly say I used to be very involved in Russia, both in mainly in academically, but Russia is a sad thing for me. I have a sadness to it because I really thought it could be a capitalist democratic country. Instead, it's turned into what my friend Tom Friedman calls a kleptocracy, and only a home for natural resources. And in fact, you know, Russia is the country that chose not to play the globalized game. It had nothing to offer. It didn't invest in the future. It didn't invest in new factories. And look at China. In defense of China, China let other companies come in, let them manufacture there, abate with joint venture partnerships, but they learned from them and they became part of the world economy. Some people will say now too much of the world economy. Russia never played that game. The game was oil. When oil was high, we are kings and we don't need to play the globalization game.
And you point out that China, the way its system is set up, that government, it tends to support old industries, prop them up.
Yes, very much so. You know, China has the major political problem. People can't vent. You can't have unemployment in China. So what does the government do? There are these old state-owned steel mills and factories such as that. And the government has to keep them in business. Totally, once again, I mentioned David Ricardo before, totally economically inefficient.
So I want to turn to the United States, because one of the things that has struck me is that there is a political reaction to globalization, whether it's the technological end of it or even just the trade end of it. And you fault particularly those people who pushed a lot of the free trade, and particularly the Republican Party, as simply having forgot about how to deal with the displacement that occurs even as you continue to grow economically.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the, you know, globalization isn't the problem. Globalization is old as humankind. I mean, Yuval Noah Harari, the famous Israeli historian, had said, you know, cultures began swallowing and absorbing other cultures from the earliest times of history. Globalization is part of human's DNA. And one could almost say it's the economic, political, culture, economic, political, and cultural version of evolution. That being said, here in the United States, when globalization, really, what we're talking about in globalization, when we're talking about low-cost jobs, manufacturing jobs, left the United States, for whatever reason, the political system didn't respond. And this is very interesting, you know, historically. In the middle of the Industrial Revolution, after the Civil War, Teddy Roosevelt looked at what was happening and saw tremendous problems with monopolization. You started to have all the antitrust acts. He looked at how industries were polluting. You started to have all those environmental pieces of legislation. The Great Depression comes. FDR does a safety net for industrial workers. For whatever reason, when globalization really hit, when manufacturing jobs started to be exported to Asia and other places, for whatever reason, our political system didn't do anything. So globalization needs to be managed, and we failed that management.
One of the things I know about is the fact that, I think it was the early 70s, the business community in particular made some decisions about trying to influence government to deregulate, for deregulation. There were think tanks created. There were other organizations put forward. And over a period of time, of course, you also saw the decline of, for instance, the number of union jobs. That all seemed to be almost purposeful in the sense that the business went ahead and did what it wanted to, what benefited itself. But in the end, it produced this sort of backlash in terms of displacement, and then obviously it becomes political.
Oh, it was so extremely short-sighted that it is amazing. And you look at things, part of globalization is down south now in the United States is full of automobile assembly plants, mainly part of globalization. Mainly foreign brands, BMW, Honda, Volkswagen, et cetera, et cetera. You have Alabama, no longer you know, when I was growing up, it was the cotton plantations state. Now it's one of the largest exporters of auto parts in the world. All this is because of globalization. But it's interesting what happened there. So these plants came into the southern United States, but they never had to follow the same labor regulations. They never had to be, they were not unionized like the plants in Detroit. Something happened there.
In terms of this particular populism we seem to be seeing, the latest I indicate was Trumpism. The resentments, the dislocation of those workers didn't really adhere to the opposition to free trade that we see now with Donald Trump. It seemed to be subsumed with, say, cultural issues, so that those people, particularly in the Republican Party, and not to bash the Republican Party, but those in the Republican Party who push for free trade, seem to still hold on to those voters.
Well, I think, you know, it's an old pact made, you know, by basically after the Civil War, that the and I think the theme constantly plays out itself in American history, where the wealthy Southerners realized they could make a deal, a political deal, and you know, for votes and get the poor redneck voters on cultural issues. And for the wealthy Southerners, that didn't make a difference to them, cultural issues. They wanted their business interests. But they made a devil's alliance. And this alliance continued through Nixon's time. Nixon reemphasized it. And it's, look at Trump's administration. You know, Trump is so, you know, his base voters, I think, have no idea what he's doing and how it will harm them in terms of deregulation and all these really, really laissez-faire types of proposals that he pushes through. They're really against the interest of his base, but he plays off the base on social value issues.
You point out, by the way, that the populism we're seeing today under Trump is a conservative populism, as opposed to, say, previous populism, say, under Roosevelt, both Roosevelts for that matter, that was more progressive. Tell me the difference that you see there.
Yeah, well, it's very interesting. Trump is very anti-European president, whose, you know, mother was from Europe, and his many wives are from Europe. Is much more of a populist in the European sense, which is this alliance that I just mentioned between big business and social, whatever those social values may be, where Franklin Roosevelt, or a better example is actually Huey Long, didn't make those, didn't make what I call that devil's connection. I mean, Huey Long was constantly in his speeches attacking millionaires. I mean, he would have thought Trump was a horror.
Well, one of the things that struck me about the European nationalism, particularly we see it today, is that European nationalism, aside from its cultural aspect, it does not do in any sense or fashion away with, say, government programs to help people out. In fact, I think in some of the Nordic countries, you've seen a reaction to some of the cuts in the social spending give rise to some of these nationalist parties. But in the United States, this nationalism seems to be connected with cutting those kinds of government assistance programs.
Well, I think that cutting, once again, because of what I keep on referring again to the devil's pact, because it's the if you protect me with my values, if you protect me with my values by giving me very conservative judges, and then a smaller minority of that group, if you protect me with my values by being semi-racist, I don't care what else you do.
So I want to turn to this idea of the both Bushes, because you are sharply criticizing them for being backing away, as it were, in some ways from globalization, even though I guess George H.W. Bush talked about the New World Order. Tell me a little bit about that critique that you have, because it seems to go beyond just simply economics.
Well, I think I think George Bush one actually was in somewhat an early globalist. I think George Bush two, I'll say, really in his international policy, in his geopolitical policy, he did everything to, in a way, prevent the world from coming to what his father talked about, to this new world order. It was a total reaction against what his father was talking about. He made it much more, difficult for Russia, who was not as aggressive at that time, to be a member to be a player. They killed the Kyoto Treaty, the first really major action for global warming. So action after action, they withdrew from what George Bush withdrew from actually what his father started to put in place.
Where does this conservatism come from, I guess, a neoconservatism? Because, particularly when I looked at some of this, one of the things that struck me is that this particularly breaking some of the arms agreements, that seemed to be, and the intervention obviously in Iraq and Afghanistan, those seem to be as if this was a giant, that is the United States, being held back by these Lilliputians, these small countries, and we couldn't do anything, that we seem to be strapped down. Vietnam probably was the last big one in terms of a war. But it does seem as if there is this frustration of that here we are, this major power, and yet we have such limits in terms of what we can do.
Well, I think, it's truly, the world changed by the time that George Bush II became president. But his advisor's mindset was still very much into the idea that America is the empire. And to a certain extent, the world changed. We had nurtured countries. We did something no one else in the world ever did in the early Cold War under Truman and Eisenhower, and actually under Johnson and through Nixon. We let our enemies become wealthy and become our partners. So whether that's Germany, whether that's Japan, and even look at what Kissinger and did with China, and then the support of Deng Xiaoping. So we let our enemies become wealthy. There were people that whose mindset didn't understand that, didn't understand that once these countries become wealthy, they want to be partners with us in the management of the global society. And that's totally logical.
I want to turn to immigration, because that's one of the key issues, certainly, that Trump has hailed in terms of his own particular political movement. Tell me a little bit about the benefit that you see in terms of immigration in the United States, but also the reaction in other countries as well, there's some resistance to it.
One, we have to say that we are a country, as we know, immigrants. I mean, everyone in this country, except for Native Americans, who were, of course, here first, and the African Americans who were brought here, slaves, voluntarily, more or less, chose to come here as immigrants to start a new life. We are a country of immigrants. To deny that is to deny our DNA, who we are. Being an immigrant country has really gained us a dynamic that other countries didn't have, because we have this whole mixture of cultures that intellectually and culturally challenge each other and gives us a new way to look at the world. Other countries don't have that. So it's really been beneficial to our culture. Saying that, though, on the other hand, you can't have, of course, open borders. You can't let everybody in, else there'll be no culture. It will be totally destroyed. So there needs some regulation. Trump, of course, is using it as an issue basically as a populist, not even a populist, the pure racist issue to stop immigrants. And that's really, I think, harmful to our economy. One of the other, and one of the direct things about immigration here in the United States is how young our population is. These are all the other major industrial countries. We have one of the youngest populations because of immigration. Because of that, that's a direct future stimulus to our economy, having such a young population.
Because you mentioned, for instance, Angela Merkel in Germany sort of taking the right approach, even though it's politically risky, to encourage immigration, as we saw in Europe, as opposed to, say, Viktor Orban in Hungary.
Right. Well, Germany has the problem of it's an aging society. For whatever reason, Europe has basically gone out of the baby-making business. Not my expertise, for sure, why that has happened. So they need immigrants desperately to work in the factories, once again, to have young people paying Social Security tax so that it supports the retirees. For the German economy to continue to flourish, it needs immigration. And that's why Merkel did an amazing thing. In my mind, she's a great leader. But she let in 1 million immigrants, and, you know, she got a lot of political flak for it. She did it both for humanitarian reasons and really basic economic reasons for Germany's future. It was a brilliant move. But yet, of course, she had a lot of political heat from it. But sometimes leaders need to make those types of decisions.
It reminds me of Japan, which was is rising economic power, certainly is becoming into the 70s and the 80s, and its population itself has this aging problem.
Japan has the oldest population of any major industrial country, and it's a huge problem. Added to that, of course, is the lack of women in its workforce, so it has a double whammy.
So in terms of immigration, obviously we absorb various cultures. We know that, for instance, the white population is going to probably be below 50% within the next few decades. What does that mean in terms of people who look at the country, the way they grew up in it, and they say, gee, it's changing. I feel uncomfortable. What happens to them? Or do they just simply die off? I mean, what's...
You know, it is difficult, but it's a reality, you know. Change, once again, change, it's like globalization being on part... being part of evolution. Change is part of that. And one has to get used, that's being a human being, getting used to change. I mean, I'm going to give an out-of-the-way analogy here, but think about Rochester, New York. Rochester, New York used to be the camera capital of the world, making Kodak Brownie cameras. No one has a Kodak Brownie camera anymore. Why? Because it's the cameras in your iPhone. That's change. It happens. That, you know, it had nothing to do with globalization. That's change.
But what about the change in the culture, bringing different people in? We certainly saw that in the 1920s, obviously, and they have slapped an immigration reform act back then. I think part of the problem, too, is not just simply economic, but a cultural thing that they see. I mean, I know people, for instance, who walk around, and even the Eastern Shore, Maryland, very conservative, they see signs of Spanish, and they feel as if they're alienated from the place that they lived. I mean, how does one deal with that? I mean, or is there a way to deal with it?
You know, it is tough, and once again, in U.S. history, we've always gone through these periods of more immigration, then closing immigration a bit, then having more immigration, then when there's been too much of a political reaction, closing it a bit. This is not a new phenomenon in U.S. history. But we see that, it's like the old World War II movies where the soldiers, they would give the names of the people, you know, who were fighting in these movies. And it would always be someone with an Italian name from the Bronx in New York and someone with an Irish name from Boston. I mean, they blend in these eventually, in a generation or two, these new immigrants blend into American culture.
By the way, I return to the 2016 election, because you seem, I believe you write that it was really a victory for the rural areas as opposed to the cities. What did you mean by that?
Well, I think it was, first, it's how the Electoral College was set up. But basically, it not so much rural as victory for the areas that lost industry, partly because of globalization, more because of, on my mind, because of automation. That frustration burst open in the 2016 election, where the urban areas, whether it's New York, San Francisco, D.C., Baltimore, where you're near, Chicago, these areas boomed from globalization, and they became magnets, actually, attracting the best and the brightest from the rural areas to the cities, and really left a lot of the rural areas kind of desolate, and where the best and brightest left.
Given that the fact that we are operating with this sort of 18th century document, the Constitution, which, as you indicate, gives land in many ways more representation than people, is that going to continue, do you think? I mean, do you think that those spaces are going to continue to dominate American politics, or do you think the populations in terms of the cities is going to catch up?
Well, the system is fixed at the moment in favor of them, as you just mentioned. I always think of the 1787 Constitution is a wonderful document, but you know, what modern American corporation would have its operating system written for a 1787 world? So we're in the same place. So that's a huge problem. And I don't know, obviously, I don't know how COVID will change this. You know, I don't know if rural areas in working at home will take power away from the cities. I have no idea.
Interesting. You mentioned, by the way, you have, three items of some kind of political solutions to the United States primary system, Citizens United, gerrymandering. Tell me a little bit about those solutions.
Well, not so much solutions. I think the primary system is a major problem. You know, it was developed by Follett and other people as a reform, especially I think in California as a reform. And it's turned out to be not a reform, but it's turned out to give minority excess power. I mean, our Constitution gives the minority voice, which is really an excellent thing. Few other documents do that, few other political documents. But the primary system gives the minority a veto power. And so if we look at many Republican Congress people, many Republican senators, they have this constant threat over their head that unless they really stay on the true party line, the true extremely conservative party line, they will be primaried. This is a problem because it closes out other voices. You don't have a more fluid Republican Party because of the threat of primary.
So how does the Citizens United, in terms of the kind of money we're seeing poured into these things?
Well, that's a huge other problem. I mean, Citizens United seems to me takes away the idea of one person, one vote. Because if I'm extremely, extremely wealthy and can give a major, major donation or corporation a major, major donation to a political party or a candidate, I have more power than the person who just can vote.
Finally, just briefly, are you optimistic that the country will be able to adapt, or are you pessimistic?
I change day by day.
You do.
Honestly, I change day by day.
Okay, well, we'll leave it there. We've been speaking with Edward Goldberg. He teaches at the New York University's Center for Global Affairs, and he's written a new book called Why Globalization Works for America, and we appreciate you taking the time to speak with us this morning.
Thank you so much, and great question.
Thank you. This has been Del Marva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.